Hello, and welcome to Open Source Education. I'm Teemu Areno, and this time I'm excited to bring you the latest session in our series of Future of Open Source in Education. Our guest today is Steve Downs. This is the second part.
Let's talk about communities. Seems like the impact of the internet has changed the society away from solitary local groups towards networked individualism, in a sense. It reminds me of learner-centered learning.
Sure. Well.
The move towards fragmented and heavily communicating social networks is probably going to transform learning as well, because people are not anymore that organized locally, but they are reaching a lot further away. It's community, the primary unit of learning in the future, as the community is distributed.
Some people like communities. I mean, some people work well in communities. Some people don't. And some people like small communities. Other people like big communities. Some people like highly structured communities. I like highly structured communities. I love Robert's rules of order and points of procedure. And I'm in my element in that kind of community. Other people like informal communities, you know, talking around in the living room, having a chat, things like that. I don't like that environment. It doesn't have enough structure for me.
You are a geek, right?
So, the Myers-Briggs stuff, INTP, very I, very N, very T, so people pick different kinds of communities, and just as the internet allowed us to pick our very specific community by topic out there, you can go out there, you know, you find a community based on beekeeping, and you know, you might be the only person in your city that has any interest in bees whatsoever, but you've got this worldwide network of bees and beekeepers. Well, in the same way, learners can pick their own kind of community. They can go out there as solitary agents and you know, like a lot of geeks do, right? You know, they'll read discussions from a variety of boards, they'll read the text, the technical specifications, things like that. They'll have a great time with that. Other people will look for the more social-oriented sort of things, the Yahoo group kind of things. Other people will look for less tightly connected communities, like a collection of blogs where they can control their own input and they choose for themselves who the other members of their community are. You know, we have this picture of community that's come from people like Etienne Winger and Hegel and Armstrong and all of that. A community is some sort of discrete entity. It's like a pre-Wittgensteinian definition where you have clear boundaries and you know whether or not you're in a community. But the concept of community that evolves out of the capacity to exercise choice in the joining or not joining of a community is something that now becomes fuzzy. It becomes something like a family resemblance. Well, okay, it looks like a little bit like a cluster. A community is more like a cloud now. Maybe you're in it, maybe you're not, who knows. And it doesn't matter whether you're in it or not. Because really what it is, a set of interactions that the user defines for him or herself on an as-needed basis with other people or with online services. And then a community just becomes a vaguely defined cloud of interactions, this cluster that emerges from the set of individual actions. So like we have folksonomies, we'll have folksunities, if you will.
Let's talk about open content, as we should talk of something about open source as well. Some time ago, you wrote the Regina Declaration article about the importance of open content in education. There is a valid point that commercial publishers, as the controllers of content, are pushing continuing constraints over our educational system. Creative Commons is making traditional copyright irrelevant by a copyleft approach to content, although there is still a long road to provide an alternative to buying a book when a course starts. This continuous battle of control and freedom leads to problems we have to fight in order to maintain an alternative or free culture, as Lawrence Lessig talks about it. What problems are we facing, and how educational institutions and people should act, in your opinion, make sure that the free culture and open content in education is something that is useful in the future?
Yeah, and this is the defining issue of the internet. All the other issues are just technical issues compared to this one. All of the other ones are easily solved compared to this one. It's a clash of cultures, or as I said in my little thing for eLearn magazine, it's a culture wars and consolidation. And basically, it's the divide between an open society and a closed society, where an open society is one in which anyone can express an opinion, and a closed society is one in which only a small number of privileged people or privileged groups can express an opinion. And I put it that way because if you look at the background and the mechanisms that were operating when I put the Regina Declaration out there, the context was an online conference hosted by the Commonwealth of Learning. And so the participants were, for the most part, educators and educational administrators and librarians. And they're looking at the difficulties of acquiring resources for the provision of online learning. And what's happening is that institutions are having a more and more difficult time being able to afford things like journal articles, course textbooks, online learning packages, because publishers are increasingly selling these in bundles or subscription packages, and they're creating, through these selling mechanisms, a scarcity of the resource and a low purchaser base, which drives up the price, right? It's like they're creating an artificially created lack of demand.
Right.
And the mechanism they use is to make it so difficult for an individual to publish that the only selection that a college or university has is from the commercial offerings of these publishers. And that's why I'm involved in the dispute over digital rights metadata formats, because the metadata format favored by publishers would impose a royalty on any use of digital rights, even Creative Commons, if Creative Commons is expressed in metadata. And this would mean that there is a cost associated with publishing a free resource, which makes it really hard to publish a free resource. So what the Regina Declaration said, it's very simple, very similar to the Budapest Declaration and the Berlin Declaration, is that educational institutions should do two things. Number one, they should make the resources produced by that institution freely available to anyone through the World Wide Web. You might think, well, that's just a lost proposition, right? They're going to incur this expense for putting this material on the web, and they're not going to get anything for it. But the other side of it is, educational institutions should stop paying for this kind of material. Cancel the journal subscriptions. Cancel the textbook purchases. Cancel the course pack purchases. Now what happens is, all of a sudden, you freed up a large amount of money in your budget. Millions of dollars in some cases. Now you can easily pay for putting your own material online, right? And obviously it costs a fraction of that. If everybody does that, then everybody has access to the same material that they did before. And in fact, so much more material. And they have access to it for a fraction of what they were paying for all these journal subscriptions and book purchases and the like. And more importantly, it also opens up the marketplace. Now me, I'm a writer, I write articles, essays and things, but I write unpopular stuff. I write stuff that publishers don't like, because I write against publishers, right?
Right.
And so publishers aren't going to distribute my stuff. You have to toe a certain along with publisher. One thing you have to do is you have to give them your copyright. You have to give them all your rights, right? You have to give that to them for free. They own your stuff. They won't publish your article or your book unless they own it outright. And there's a limited number of publishers, so they can dictate the terms and conditions. It's the same situation in the music industry. If you've ever read the article by Courtney Love, that was published in Snowlon a couple of years ago, Courtney Love Adds Up the Numbers. There's a limited number of music publishers, which means they dictate the terms to musicians. So she describes a situation in which a band had a gold album, sold 1 million copies, and as a result of that, the band ended up in debt, owing money to the music publishers.
Yeah.
Because the publisher, all whatever their expenses are, and of course they charge ridiculous rates for everything, so they end up, they have a bestseller, they end up owing money. University professors get off lucky. They just don't get paid anything. So having an open access system allows me, the writer of unpopular material, or it allows Courtney Love, a musician who doesn't want to lose money by singing songs, to contribute our material into this worldwide academic network. We can put our material in. Now, our material stands right beside the commercial publisher's material. It's like if you go to a grocery store and beans, cans of beans in the grocery store, well, my free beans are sitting right beside the beans that cost 59 cents. And you look at those beans and you say, well, which beans do I want? If my beans look good enough, you'll pick my beans. If my beans don't look good enough, then you'll pay the money and get the commercial beans. But this kind of competition from free content providers is what really, really scares content publishers. They'll talk until they're blue about file sharing and people stealing their content. But what they're really afraid of is that people won't want their content because there's better, cheaper content out there. And so they're trying to close the marketplace.
Yeah, you are saying that instead of paying for content, acquiring content, you should start creating content.
And right,
that is driving all those publishers out of the business. They have to modify their business plans.
Well,
what do you think?
Absolutely.
What do you think? This is a great idea, but is it going to happen in the following year, say 10 years, 5 years? What kind of time frame is required? What kind of problems we have to overcome? How about digital rights management and all the problems in the legislation of copyright? There are many problems if we want to do this, and because they have so much money, they are not going to look at it. They are going to do something, and well, how we are going to turn this culture of acquiring things into creating things.
I think they're going to throw everything they've got to stop this, right? From their point of view, their business is on the line. Gladwell says, the tipping point comes when enough people have the capacity to produce and distribute resources of that type. And that's what sets up our time frame. Now, look at the news industry, newspapers in particular. Circulation rates for newspapers are in free fall. They're dropping dramatically. And they're really dropping dramatically, the 18 to 25 readership group. The readership in that group is like a fraction of what it is in the older groups. Newspapers are also losing significant revenues. For example, in the United States, there's a site called Craigslist. And what Craigslist does is it set up a site for, well, not every city, but, you know, dozens and dozens and dozens of cities across the United States. And basically all it has is classified ads. It has classified ads specific to that city. And Craigslist is draining the revenue that newspapers typically got from classified ads. Ordinary display or banner advertisement, the market is sagging for that. Google's AdWord type of advertising is drawing a large revenue base from newspapers. And what's happening, if you look at Dan Gilmore's book, We the Media, what's happening is that journalism that is produced by a central publisher and distributed typically in print form, but even in online form, is replaced by journalism that is created by a large number of people writing on the same topic. And of course, I'm referring specifically, but not exclusively, to the blogger phenomenon here, where the coverage of an event happens not just by the newspaper reporter, but also by the network of individual bloggers that are covering the event. Now, of course, we saw this most clearly in the case of the tsunami. The tsunami was one of these events where, it happened in 10 minutes and then it was over. Well, maybe an hour or two or whatever, but you know what I mean. And reporters couldn't get a reporter to cover the tsunami. It was over before anyone could catch a flight. And then all you have is the aftermath. But if you look on the web, you see page after page after page of eyewitness descriptions and photographs, video, there are many videos of the wave coming in. And all of this media was produced not by professional journalists, but by individuals who had the capacity to create their own content. That doesn't mean they became journalists properly so-called or anything like that, but what it did mean is that they became, for that particular event, personal publishers. They could produce content about that event. And after the tsunami happened, and as these things became available, then the aggregators came in, and the aggregators are just like EduRSS and others, right? But the idea is they filter, bring in, organize, and present this information. And the role of the professional journalist changes in this context, because now they are not the unique soul producers and conveyors of the knowledge. They become more like assimilators, they become more like editors, they become more like the organization that puts all of this information into context, evaluates it, weighs it, that sort of thing. So again, the key point here is it was the capacity to produce this content. Now, when the capacity to produce educational content is similarly distributed, then no matter what educational publishers can do, there will be an alternative network of educational resources developed. And then they face the choice. Join it with a new business model or watch their fortunes decline the way newspapers' fortunes are happening or declining now. 5-10 years.
Okay, thank you. That nailed it pretty much. I'm going to jump from citizen journalist to free and open source software. Currently, one of the major reasons free and Libre and open source software is interesting to many educational institutions is its cost effectiveness and basic IT infrastructure. Basically, they are looking at Linux. They are looking at open and cheap alternatives to Blackboard and WebCT and all those ancient learning management systems. Is open source also going to affect the content and methods of teaching and learning?
Oh yeah, there's no question about that. You go up there, you look on the lists, or you listen to the papers and the conferences. One of the things you hear over and over again is, well, we use such and such an LMS, and we would like to do such and such, but the way the LMS is designed, it wouldn't allow us to do it. Or you hear comments along the lines of, well, an LMS can allow you to put up a page turner or, a traditional class online, but, the way it's designed, you can't really do anything innovative with it. The thing is, when you buy proprietary software, then you have to do things the way the program designers think that you should do things. And sometimes these programs get pretty insistent. My copy of Microsoft Word still tells me to spell color the American way. I've tried everything I can to turn it off, but it insists. No U. Don't put a U in the word color. Things like that. With open source, you don't need to put up with that. With open source, you can take the software and customize it to your own needs. And more particularly, what happens, it comes back to this RSS thing again. You have the core application, and it's usually a pretty simple core, and it's something that anybody can learn how to use. But then you can begin to customize it or extend it. And because the software is open source, you get a large number of these customizations or extensions. You look at Firefox, the open source web browser. Simple web browser, really easy to use. But if you want additional features, there were all of these extensions that have been created by programmers all around the world that you can plug into it. You can add a calendar to Firefox. You can add an RSS aggregator to Firefox. You can add a wiki that has comments for every page on the internet in Firefox. All of these things, you wouldn't maybe necessarily want them if you bought it out of the box, but if the extension applies to you, then you can do it. Or PostNuke. PostNuke is an open source content management system. It's something that's used by a lot of educational institutions. It's written in PHP, it's free and open source. And PostNuke, again, has all of these modules that you can decide whether or not to add after you have the basic installation. Basic PostNuke, real simple, really easy to use. If you want a functionality, then you just plug in these modules, these PostNuke modules, and then you get a system that's a little more complex. So it's not simply the question of cost. It's to a large degree a question of being able to do with the software what you want to do with it, and a question of the community that uses the software being able to extend on the basic model that was produced as that piece of open source software. You know, and just an aside, I might remark, one of the reasons why these software products like, you know, Windows and all of that are so expensive is because you can't do this. Microsoft has to put all of this functionality into the program themselves because there's no way for users to do it. And that drives the cost of the software up. And that software less reliable. So when I buy a copy of Word, I buy 5 functions that I want and 45 functions that I don't want. And so I'm buying a lot of expensive software that I really have no use for. It's not simply that the cost is lower. I think the cost being lower is an attractive side benefit. But the real power in open source is the ability to take the software and make it your own and do what you want with it.
In education, the main benefits, they are looking at cost right now, but it seems the main benefit is customization.
Yeah. The future is in customized solutions for schools, but understand what this means. This does not mean hiring a company to create a type of software specifically designed for your schools. This is not the Toffler mass customization model. Your teachers, and even more interestingly, your students taking this basic software, this basic content management software, and adding our own customization to it. And it brings us almost full circle to where we started, right? This is shared knowledge construction, where the products, the educational software, the educational content, these are not things that are prepared, packaged, and sold to you. The products, your learning management system, your content or whatever, you start from a basic free and open source version of it, and then you make it your own by adding content, by adding customization, by adding new features, new functions. And in fact, what we'll see is that the software and the content merge. The software will look more like content. The content will look more like different degrees of the same thing. So open source is what makes it possible for a student to go in and change the parameters of his or her education. And that's to a degree what I'm trying to do with EduRSS as well. I mean, what you're doing in particular is changing the parameters of the information feed that's being delivered to you. That's the kind of customization that I'm after, where people can, if they wish, do their own customization. Or they can use their friend's customization. Or they can use a default customization. And you share these customizations as freely and easily as you share a conversation on the street.
What do you think? Who will be the losers and who are the winners?
I mean, it's hard to pick a loser or a winner in this sort of model because, you know, individuals change, organizations change, businesses change. What Xerox has done over the years, look what IBM has done over the years, and far beyond typewriters. But you can categorize in general. There's some general principles that work and some that don't. And in general, a system, a product, an organization that is distributed would generally win out over one that is centralized. So if you're looking at two competing companies, say, the one to pick as the winner is the one that has a more distributed model. By more distributed model, what I mean is the content comes from different places and not just one place. The content is available in different places and not just one place. So a network of bloggers wins out over a centralized newspaper. A newspaper syndicate wins out over a newspaper. Another principle is, in general, things that are open win out over things that are closed. Everybody talks about, well, Windows is closed and all of that. Windows is a lot more open than its competition was. Remember, the competition was Apple. And Apple was a fortress. You know, the one out was more open. And what will win out over various Microsoft is more open. The product, service, business, or whatever, that is the need of the individual consumer will win out over those designed to satisfy the needs of the provider or the institution.
What are the non-technical factors that have to be overcome?
When I look at what distinguishes the groups that are adapting to technology and the groups that are not, I always go back to Douglas Rushkoff, because Douglas Rushkoff is a real keen observer of digital culture. What he observes is that the capacity to live with change is probably central. And he talks about the cyber generation and the surf metaphor. And he says that it's no coincidence that we talk about surfing the web, and we have surfboards and we have skateboards. It's no coincidence that the skateboard culture is the same culture that is the hacker culture. The point of view that you take toward disinformation is a stance where you expect what is true today or what is the case today to be different than what it is tomorrow. And so your attitude toward it isn't one of grasping, holding on to it, controlling it, but your attitude is rather working it. Instead of trying to control the wave, you work the wave. Instead of trying to bottle the wave, you surf the wave. And I think that's probably the key non-technical factor is how you approach this. If people talk about setting up libraries and repositories and digital content, they talk about these things as being assets or intellectual property and all of that. On the other side of it, people understand, like, it's all just bits in the ether. And the bits in the ether are in constant motion, constant change. What had value yesterday has no value today, or it has value as a very different kind of value. And your relation to it is changing on a moment-to-moment basis. And so these are the people who view information as a flow rather than as a thing. And that's the model I always try to get across when I talk about what online learning looks like. Online learning is a flow. Online learning is I don't want to say commodity, that has the wrong sort of thing, but it's a thing like electricity or water where it's there, it's available, it flows. It's not something that you hang on to and collect. You know, I don't sit here in my home collecting jars of water because the stuff flows for free from my taps. What I do is I use the water as it comes, and I take the water as it comes. And the same with electricity. I don't have big giant batteries in my basement. That would make no sense. And it's the same with learning. And it's the same with the internet in general. And if you think of the internet as an environment that you have it, that is moving and shaping itself around you, then you have, I think, a better attitude to be able to with the flood of information that's coming at you. I'm looking at a complex phenomenon from one dimension with one metaphor. It's a bit limited in this way, but I think that this metaphor, looking at this thing from one direction, kind of gets at the heart of the non-technical issues.
Great stuff. Thank you, Stephen, for your interview.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you for joining us. This was Open Source in Education.